The Tom Woods Show, episode 1314.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, here's an easy way you can tick off the boxes next to two of your New Year's resolutions at once: taking better physical care of yourself and being smarter with your personal finances. You can do both when you use, you guessed it, Harry's Razors. Check out their amazing trial offer at harrys.com/woods. Folks, the Contra Cruise is coming a bit early this year, July 5th through the 12th. We will be setting sail for Alaska. Join Bob Murphy and me for what is the best libertarian event of the year. So much fun, so memorable. We'll be joined by special guests Brad and Deidre Berzer and Gene Epstein. Check it out at contracruise.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. I thought I would take a few minutes, I guess an episode, to talk about top marginal tax rates and people paying their fair share and stuff like that because of the remark that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez made about the desirability of a top marginal income tax rate of 70% that she believes can fund her Green New Deal programs. And what everybody's been saying is, look, we had these high rates. We had even higher rates in the 1950s. And look, everything was fine. So that goes to show that these would work just as well today. The thing is, things are not the same between those days and today. So I'm going to talk about that. But I first want to make sure everybody understands what we mean by a marginal income tax rate. Now, if you're an income tax payer, then you probably do know the concept because you see it in the way your taxes are calculated. But if you're a young person, let's say you're in college and you haven't actually made out an income tax return, you may not actually know how it works. So the gist of it is, if you have different income tax rate levels, which we do, the way it works is, let's say, I'm just making these up for the simplicity of the math, let's say that there are three rates. There's a 10% rate, a 20% rate, and a 30% rate. And let's say the 10% rate is on all your income up to $50,000. The 20% rate is on all your income from $50,001 up to $100,000. And then the 30% rate is everything you earn over $100,000. So let's say I earn $200,000. It doesn't mean, even though I'm in the highest bracket, doesn't mean I pay 30% on the entire $200,000. Like anybody else, I would pay 10% on the first $50,000. So I'd pay $5,000 there. On the second $50,000, I would pay 20%, so another $10,000 for a total of $15,000 so far. And then on the second half of my income, the $100,001 up to $200,000, I would pay the 30% on that portion. So I'd pay $30,000 on that for a grand total of $45,000. That's the way it works. So then we get my effective tax rate by looking at that $45,000 and comparing it to my overall income. So the effective tax rate is going to be lower than the top marginal rate because the top marginal rate does not apply to my entire income. Now, I assume most people knew that already, but if you didn't, we couldn't have this conversation. So I had to just make sure and explain that. So I wrote a little something about this actually in my email newsletter. And at this point, you may be thinking, this Woods in this email newsletter, you know, if he'll just stop talking about it, I'll sign up already. You know, if I could just get him to shut up about it, for heaven's sake, I will sign up already. Well, do that. Do that because you're going to get a great new ebook I released called Our Enemy, the Fed. And it goes through the arguments against the Federal Reserve, and it replies to the usual lackey arguments in favor. And you can check it out at ourenemythefed.com, and that also, at the same time, signs you up for my list. Well, anyway, I sent out a little email about this. So I'm going to go over a few of the points in that, and then I want to embellish that a bit. I want to add some stuff from some other sources. And so we'll start with this comment by, she's now going by the initials AOC. So why not, right? We'll call her AOC. AOC says, people are going to have to start paying their fair share in taxes. This is what she said in a 60 Minutes interview. People are going to have to start paying their fair share in taxes. They're going to have to start paying their fair share. They have not been paying their fair share up to now. And it never, ever satisfies these people to say that the top 1% paid 44% of all the income taxes, as in the most recent statistics that we have. This never, ever satisfies them. What percent would, you know, and I actually sometimes wonder if I were to ask people on the street, like, for example, you remember months ago, I told you this interesting statistic about how extreme poverty in the world has been cut roughly in half over the past several decades. And yet, when you ask Americans, do you believe that poverty around the world has stayed the same, been cut in half, or, you know, gotten much worse? 95% of Americans said stayed the same or gotten much worse. So demonstrably false. That's absolutely false. There is no statistic that'll bear out that point of view. And yet they absolutely believe it. I think maybe not quite 95%, but a really, really high percentage. If I said to you, what percent of all income tax receipts do you think are collected from the top 1%? How much do they contribute in taxes? They'd probably say maybe 1%, 2 or 3%, because they've probably not thought it through. Obviously, it would have to be way more than 1%. But even if they said 10 or 20%, they're not even in the ballpark. So when you say, and then the top 10% is paying at least 70%, well, you know, what would be their fair share, if not that? What exactly would be their fair share? So what's the deal with this top marginal tax rate of 91% that then came down to 70%? Well, what's interesting about this is how few people actually ever paid that rate. How few people were actually touched by it because of how wealthy you needed to be even to fall into these brackets. But then if you did, there were lots of ways out of them. There are many loopholes that no longer exist that existed at that time. It was much easier to fudge these things on your taxes than it is today. And we can see, for example, even Thomas Piketty admits that by 1960 in the U.S., the effective tax rate for the top earners was 31%. Not 91%, but 31%. And we also know that it's just a fact, it's an interesting fact that persists throughout the second half of the 20th century, that once you're past the Korean War, it looks as if the federal government simply cannot manage for any length of time to wring out of the American public in taxes more than 18 to 20% of GDP. That's about where it maxes out. And that's an astonishing level of consistency over such a long period of time, considering the wide variability of the marginal tax rates over that time, that you went from 91% as a top marginal rate down to 28% by the end of Ronald Reagan's term. And yet throughout that period, this relationship continues to hold, that the federal government still collects about this amount in tax receipts as a percentage of GDP. So something's going on here, that you have that wide span of tax rates, and yet the receipts as a percentage of GDP are about the same. Well, something's going on. But now getting back to this top marginal rate issue, I want to read a comment from a tax planner on this subject. And I'm going to link to this stuff so that you can look at the ins and outs. Because, I mean, just giving technical details in a podcast episode is not ideal. What I'll do is give you the points, and then if you want the nitty-gritty, I'll have the links up at tomwoods.com/1314. But here's what a tax planner says. The dishonesty or perhaps ignorance in the tax debate that's going on today is the complete misrepresentation of the pre-TRA 86 higher marginal tax rates in the old 53 code. TRA 86 means the Tax Reform Act of 1986. Sure, the marginal rates were insane, but the underlying tax code was rife with loopholes that a good tax planner, I was one, could exploit to get a person's effective tax rate as low or lower than it is today. Those loopholes are no longer part of the tax code, which is a good thing, he says, since they encouraged investors to invest in projects that had no economic viability other than the income sheltering effect they created. All right, we can argue that point, that that's not central to his argument. He says, what else is ignored in the conversation is the fact that there was a massive amount of tax fraud at all income levels under the old code. It was so bad and so common that most people took pride in telling others how they cheated on their taxes. When I was practicing, it was quite common for us to pick up clients who had owned businesses that had grown into large enterprises that cheated extensively on their income taxes, sometimes for decades. Usually the only reason this ever got exposed was due to the owners wanting to sell or go public. Today, it would be very hard to get away with significant tax fraud for very long, and the current code does not offer very many ways to legally shelter income. So, a marginal tax rate of 70% in the current climate would probably produce an effective tax rate on the top 5% of at least 45 to 50%, which would be more than double what the effective rate was under the old tax code. Thus, if we were to go back to those insane marginal tax rates, we would be crossing into a level of taxation never seen in this country. But that doesn't stop people from making outlandish claims about how wonderful things were in the 1950s and 1960s. And this just goes to show that, of course, we can sustain these top marginal tax rates and society is wealthier when we soak the rich. And there's just no context whatsoever. There's no sense of the difference between the global economy then and the global economy today, how much international competition there was then and how much there is today. There's no sense of any of this. There's the sense that if we can just go back to the unionized 1950s, everything will be fine. Labor unions are on the decline. They're going to continue to be on the decline. And that's because if you're going to raise wages to exceptionally high rates, you're going to be instantly uncompetitive. So this is a fantasy world they're living in. And there's really no causal mechanism spelled out. What exactly is the benefit of confiscating the wealth of the rich? Like, where does the economic progress come from in this? Is it that you just seize resources from people and sprinkle them around and that makes the economy work better? I mean, you do get the sense that that is what some of these people are saying, because for many of these people, they think the economy is a bunch of people with a bunch of products and pieces of paper changing hands from one person to the other as they give these products to each other. This to them is the entire economy. This is how the economy works. So if you want to stimulate the economy, why, you try to give more money to poorer people because they will be more likely to go down to the retail store and buy cigarettes or whatever, and then the cigarette seller can buy something, and then somebody else can buy something, and we'll all be able to buy and sell from each other, and that will stimulate the economy. That's the level we're dealing with. They think that's how the economy works, that people who are more likely to consume, you see these memes on Facebook. People who are more likely to consume are the ones who really help the economy, whereas the rich are just hoarding resources arbitrarily because they have some kind of fetish for the money itself, presumably. But if that were the case, and I've noted this before, but if that were the case, then think about what this means. If that's what the economy is, it's just I have money and I go buy a shirt and the shirt seller takes the money and he buys a chicken dinner and the chicken dinner salesman takes the money and he goes and buys a new pair of shoes, and the shoe salesman takes the money and he goes and buys four movie tickets. And then, okay, well then in that, where the idea of consumption being, and I realize I'm dealing with a very, very low level economic argument, but unfortunately it's the kind of argument that's made by almost everybody, especially on social media. If that's really what the economy is all about, then where is capital maintenance coming from? Where's the maintenance on the stuff that keeps production going? Stuff that consumers don't buy. You and I don't buy assembly line equipment. You and I don't buy capital goods, like we don't buy drill presses. Who's paying for those? You need them in order to keep the productive machine going so that it doesn't crank down to zero. Somebody's got to do that. Somebody's got to maintain the current capital structure. Somebody's got to add to the current capital structure to make the economy more physically productive so that we can produce more stuff. And when we produce more stuff, competition lowers the prices relative to wage rates and our real wages go up. This is the healthy process by which a normal, unhampered market economy provides an ever-increasing standard of living to the general public. Or how about product development? At any stage in that exchange of money that I just described, where did any of that go toward product development or research and development or anything like that? Of course, nowhere. Where's the payment of wages coming from? If it's just one person consuming and then the person who gets that money consumes, then the other person consumes and consumption drives the whole thing, where do wages get paid? So none of this is even considered. Well, you know what? Maybe the money that the so-called rich get, maybe that's where the money to pay wages comes out of. Maybe that's where the money for capital maintenance comes from. And if you don't have capital maintenance, we revert to barbarism. So yeah, it turns out, hey, how about that? The rich actually have a role. The rich are not just cows to be milked. They actually play a non-parasitical role. Who is funding the capital goods purchases? Where's that coming from? Consumers aren't buying those things. So now going from this point, let me say a little something drawn from George Reisman, who has an article I'm also going to link to at tomwoods.com/1314, who is, you could just hear the contempt that he has for people who think this way coming through his article. He has an article whose subtitle, the main title, because it's an old article, is Anti-Obamanomics, and the subtitle is Why Everyone Should Be in Favor of Reducing Taxes on the, quote, rich. And it's really well done. Now, I know there's nuance here. I get that there are plenty of quite unlibertarian factors that make some rich people rich. I get that. And I will link to our Contra Krugman episode on how monetary policy skews the, I hate saying income distribution, because it's not distribution, but in the case of artificial moves toward inequality, it is a kind of distribution, isn't it? So how monetary policy contributes to inequality. It is astonishing to me that the progressive left has no interest in this factor whatsoever. I mean, you could at least imagine them saying, well, that may be a factor, but it's not the driving one. They're not even going to say that. They're not even aware that it exists, or they've never thought of it. You have this giant banking cartel created by the most influential bankers. This elicits zero curiosity from these people. I mean, that's amazing to me. How could you be so uncurious about the world? All right, anyway, I want to read a few passages from this piece by George Reisman. It's quite a long piece, but I do want to point this out. Oh, and by the way, on that stuff about, just before I forget, that stuff about how over time there's a consistent percentage of tax receipts as a percentage of GDP paid over time, no matter what the rates are, they always end up collecting between 18 and 20% of GDP in taxes. If somebody comes back at you with, but is that just personal income tax? That's all taxes. We're talking here about personal income taxes. Maybe that changes it. But those have actually been consistently between 7 and 9%. So again, that's not a shot against the point that I'm making, that the point I'm making includes all taxes, whereas marginal income tax rates deal only with personal income taxes. Those too have been consistent over the years. All right, anyway, let's get to George Reisman, because he's going to elaborate and really kind of build on what I was more or less hinting at just here. Now, bear in mind this part of what I'm about to tell you, the Reisman part, there's no point in trying to share this with your friends. This is just for your knowledge so that you'll understand how the world works. Your friends will hear this and say, oh, that's trickle-down economics. And so they've gotten to a point where they're going to reduce certain kinds of thinking just to some demonized term. There's no way you're going to cut through that. They will not be able to think. But you will at least know how the world works, and that's something. He says, the progressive personal income tax, the corporate income tax, the inheritance tax, and the capital gains tax are all paid with funds that otherwise would have been saved and invested. All of these taxes reduce the demand for labor by business firms in comparison with what it would otherwise have been, and thus either the wage rates or the volume of employment that business firms can offer, because they deprive business firms of the funds with which to pay wages. By the same token, they deprive business firms of the funds with which to buy capital goods. This, together with the greater spending for consumers' goods emanating from the government as it spends the tax proceeds, causes the production of capital goods to drop relative to the production of consumers' goods. This implies a reduction in the degree of capital intensiveness in the economic system, and thus its ability to implement technological advances. The individual and corporate income taxes and the capital gains tax, of course, also powerfully reduce the incentive to introduce new products and improve methods of production. In all these ways, these taxes undermine capital accumulation and the rise in the productivity of labor and real wages, and thus the standard of living of everyone, not just of those on whom the taxes are levied. And then further on, he says, One benefits from other people's means of production, not only in one's capacity as a buyer of products, but also as a seller of labor. Other people's means of production, other people's capital, are the source both of the supply of the goods one buys and of the demand for the labor one sells. The greater is other people's accumulation of capital, the more abundant and less expensive are the products available for one to buy in the market, and the greater is the demand for the labor one sells in the market, and thus the higher the wages at which one can sell it. Abundant and growing capital in the hands of one's suppliers and potential employers is the foundation of low and falling prices and of high and rising wages. And then still further, he says, let's suppose you had a choice. Would you like your taxes to be reduced by $1,000? Or would you like John D. Rockefeller's taxes to be reduced by $1,000? Well, obviously, it makes sense for you to say, I want my taxes reduced by $1,000. He says, the fallacy that people then fall into is to think that collectively it would be to the benefit of me and my standard of living if all wage earners, like let's suppose I were taken out of the question, I didn't get any tax break at all, but I were to ask myself, for the sake of my standard of living, would it be better for the class of wage earners to get $1,000 tax reduction, or would it be better for the class of businessmen and capitalists to have their taxes reduced by the same amount? Now, I realize what I'm about to tell you is just not, you're not allowed to say it, right? You're not even allowed to think it. But what Riesman is arguing is that it's not correct to extrapolate from the fact that if you as a laborer are benefited from a $1,000 tax reduction, that you have some kind of class solidarity with all laborers and that it would benefit you more for all of them to get a little bit of tax relief as opposed to businessmen and capitalists. Now, of course, from a moral point of view, I want everybody's taxes to be reduced or eliminated. I mean, you know that. But the question is, what are the economic effects? So he asks this question. What is the consequence of such a reduction on businessmen and capitalists? He says, a tax reduction on businessmen and capitalists will promote capital accumulation far, far more than a tax reduction on the mass of the individual wage earners, fellow wage earners. The average businessman and capitalist will save and invest the taxes he no longer has to pay in far greater proportion than would the average wage earner. And by the way, there's no way that a critic could deny this, because isn't that the flip side of precisely why they think wage earners deserve the tax relief? Because the wage earner will consume more. They openly admit this. So they can't have it both ways. They openly admit, because they think it's a virtue, because they don't understand anything beyond consumption. And then Riesman continues that the businessman and capitalist will be induced to introduce more improvements in products and methods of production, which are also a major cause of capital accumulation, and is a process in which wage earners, qua wage earners, play little or no role. And then as a caveat, he says, this is not to say that wage earners are never responsible for innovations. They often are. But as soon as they are, they typically become businessmen. Fundamentally, it is always the prospect of higher profits that stimulates innovations, not the earning of higher wages. It is the prospect of higher profits that leads employers to offer incentives to wage earners to make innovations. And then, again, returning to his line of argument, and the greater saving of the businessmen and capitalists will produce innovation by virtue of making the economic system more capital intensive. Thus, the individual wage earner has far more to gain from the taxes of businessmen and capitalists being reduced than from the taxes of his fellow wage earners being reduced. Now, of course, again, as we've seen in previous episodes and as I've written about a lot, the basic mechanism by which increased capital accumulation leads to an increase in all real incomes, not just wages, but all real incomes, is that you have, with increased capital intensiveness, you now are more physically productive because machines can produce more stuff than people producing stuff by hand. That's the only reason you would invest in the machines. So now, with fewer inputs, you can get vastly more outputs. And this now puts downward pressure on the prices of those goods. Now, if you didn't have the Fed constantly increasing the money supply, you would see this more clearly in a more consistently falling price level. We see falling prices in this or that industry these days, but before we had the Fed, prices were consistently falling in line with this kind of story that I'm telling. And you would see this more consistently otherwise. But certainly the point is they fall relative to wage rates because competition puts downward pressure on the prices of these now more abundant goods. And that means that your paycheck can stretch much farther. That's the mechanism. And so Reisman summarizes his argument this way. He says, the individual wage earner gains from cutting the taxes of businessmen and capitalists in part because the effect of their sharply increased saving is significantly to raise the demand for labor, and thus quite possibly significantly to raise his own wage income. And then he says, even if the effect is not to raise wage rates, but in raising the demand for labor to reduce or eliminate unemployment, that too operates to increase the funds available to the average wage earner by virtue of reducing what he must pay to support the unemployed. And then he concludes, but far more importantly, the effect of cutting the taxes of businessmen and capitalists rather than of wage earners will be a substantial rise in the demand for capital goods relative to the demand for consumers' goods, and a substantial rise in the rate of innovation, including under the latter head the ability of upstart new firms to grow rapidly and thus to challenge old established firms. All right, we've got more stuff we got to review here for the sake of thoroughness. But before doing that, I want to recommend to you a way you might be able to save about 100 smackers this year. If you're a regular shaver, that's what you'll save by using Harry's razors, which are the official razors of the Tom Woods Show. I've been using them for quite a while now. Even with a beard, you still have to shave part of the face unless you want to look like a lumberjack. By the way, nothing wrong with being a lumberjack. We need them, right? But not everybody wants to have the lumberjack look. And my Harry's razors give me a smooth, comfortable shave every time. And they're not focused on silly gimmicks like vibrating heads or handles that look like spaceships. They just want to get you durable, sharp blades that get you an excellent shave. Get a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. A weighted ergonomic handle, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Listeners of my show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/woods. Make sure you go to harrys.com/woods to redeem your offer and let them know I sent you to help support the show. I want to return now to a post I wrote some time ago on this general subject of America was doing great when tax rates were so high, because one critic said, look, we had, in those days, our education system was the envy of the world. That's what he said. And I added this. Left out is that when our education system was supposedly, quote, the envy of the world, it was spending far less per capita, adjusting for inflation, than it does today. From the early 1970s to 2003 alone, spending per capita doubled. So the left has actually gotten its wish, although it pretends it hasn't. Meanwhile, Japan, spending one-third as much per capita and with much larger class sizes, vastly outperforms the U.S. There is no connection between higher education spending, I don't mean spending on higher education, I mean increased education spending, and higher SAT scores. In fact, some of the highest scores are earned in states that spend the least on education, and Washington, D.C., which spends the most, is dead last. As for the prosperity of the 1950s and 60s, let's say, first of all, with the 1950s, John F. Kennedy actually used the 1950s economy against Vice President Richard Nixon in the 1960 election. So it was not obvious to JFK that this was the greatest economy in the history of mankind. You had an average economic growth rate per year of 2.4% under Dwight Eisenhower. Now, that's not a bad record. Nobody's denying that. But it's hardly the earth-shattering, historically unique figure you might expect in light of these constant references to the prosperity of the 1950s. And let's think back to what did that prosperity look like? I've often used the example of The Honeymooners, which is a TV show from the 1950s that I like very much. Now, bearing in mind Ralph Cramden, played by Jackie Gleason, is a notorious cheapskate, and everybody knows this. But even factoring that in, it was plausible that a family might not have a telephone, or a television, or a refrigerator. Some people still had ice boxes. A guy would bring a giant ice cube to your house, and you use that to keep your food cold. That was still going on at that time. So even though he was a cheapskate, his apartment was not laughed out of court as being totally implausible, because you did know people like that. So if anybody who wants to live at the standard of living of the Cramdens from the 1950s, if you're so attached to the Cramdens, you could do that on a single income. No problem. You could do that. And moreover, today, probably 95% of Americans own cell phones. The vast majority of those are smartphones, which is a technology that would have seemed out of science fiction in the 1950s. Then also, we can say something about the 1960s, because that's another decade that was really prosperous, and we had still pretty high marginal income tax rates. They were reduced to 70% under Kennedy. But there you had a Federal Reserve-fueled boom. So during JFK's term, M2 growth averaged about 8% per year. And that produces, as you know, resource misallocation that can look like prosperity. But that false prosperity is self-reversing. And what's funny is Arthur Oaken, who had been on the Council of Economic Advisors, influential White House economist all through the 1960s, he was boasting in 1970 that the business cycle had been tamed forever. And that was the exact moment that the recession began. Beautiful, poetic justice. So that false prosperity was paid for with a decade of inflation and stagnation. Mark Thornton of the Mises Institute, who's been a guest with me several times, says, from the beginning of 1946 to the beginning of 1965, the consumer price index increased by 71.4%, but then increased 20% by the end of the decade. From 1965, when the experiment began in earnest, to the end of 1980, the CPI increased by 176.6%. The experiment had tripled the rate of inflation experienced by consumers. But it's not just price inflation and unemployment we should look to for the full story of basically how Americans wound up paying for the fake prosperity of the 60s. Mark says this, a better indication is to be found in the fact that in May 1970, a portfolio consisting of one share of every stock listed on the big board was worth just about half of what it would have been worth at the start of 1969. The high flyers that had led the market of 1967 and 1968, conglomerates, computer leasers, far-out electronics companies, franchisers, were precipitously down from their peaks. Nor were they down 25% like the Dow, but 80, 90, or 95%. This was vintage 1929 stuff, and the prospect of another Great Depression, this one induced as much by despair as by economic factors as such, was a very real one. The stock market, as measured by the Dow, did decrease 25% between 1969 and 1971, and then lost another 20% by mid-1975. However, the real losses in the stock market were larger and longer lasting than an ordinary chart of the Dow might suggest. And then he's got a graph showing that the Dow index shows that stocks tended to trade in a wide channel for much of the period between 1965 and 1984. However, if you adjust the value of stocks by price inflation as measured by the consumer price index, a clearer and more disturbing picture emerges. The inflation-adjusted or real purchasing power measure of the Dow indicates that it lost nearly 80% of its peak value. Very significant. Now, finally, even if we were to accept that the 1950s were the summit of human happiness, correlation does not prove causation. How do we know there wouldn't have been even greater prosperity had taxes been lower? Now, supporters of their view of this AOC view would have to provide us with a causal mechanism explaining why the violent seizure of property and its expenditure on economically arbitrary projects would make a country more prosperous than employing those funds in capital investment to increase the productivity of labor. I can point to plenty of relatively limited government places around the world that are doing very well economically, and our critics would not accept that that proves the thing. And they're partly right. Without a theoretical understanding of what produces prosperity, we can't know if country A is prosperous because of, or in spite of, policy B. That's why it helps to understand how the world works, and that is why my guests and I are here every single weekday. All right, that's it for today. I'm going to have some interesting stuff at tomwoods.com/1314 if you want some more meat on this general topic. Also, I want to tell you about a website created by one of my listeners, because I not only do I like to promote these, but occasionally when it's a business-related website, I like the idea that we help each other out, and not for charity, but because our people produce really good stuff, And it's good for us to have these economic interactions with each other as well. So I have a fellow who started a website called UtahCopywriting.com. And of course, that's copyright. It's not copyright like intellectual property, obviously. It's copywriting, C-O-P-Y-W-R-I-T-I-N-G, copywriting, like you write advertising copy. And he provides professional copywriting services and general content creation to businesses. And he can do almost all forms of copywriting, ads and whatever. But he also has experience with SEO, search engine optimization, and he really can do good copy work for businesses unsatisfied with their site's search engine ranking. So instead of paying an SEO company huge prices, you can bring UtahCopywriting.com on board, and they can fulfill copy and SEO needs simultaneously. Throw in storytelling expertise, a competitive nature, and a knack for producing effective results quickly, and you have the ideal partner for all your copy needs. You don't have to live in Utah. Of course, Utah Copywriting does copywriting for businesses all over the country. Check it out at UtahCopywriting.com. I'll link to that also at TomWoods.com/1314. And if you would like a nice shout out for your website, make sure before you start that site, you get your hosting through me. I'll get you a great price. And I'll give you this and several other valuable bonuses that'll give you a nice head start. So check out those bonuses at TomWoods.com/publicity, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.